even some very worthwhile charity work. But to what end? Did any of that really matter now? What was more important than squeezing in a conversation with my son about respecting women and other cultures and races? I thought about Kirk and the $100 bills in my bag, how they pretty much summed up his approach to life, at least recently. I thought about our marriage, wondering exactly when our priorities had shifted away from our relationship and toward other things. I thought about all our small, seemingly insignificant daily choices and their cumulative effect, how they may have impacted Finch, even subconsciously. He certainly didn't see his parents talking much these days, and when we did, it was often about money or other superficial things. Even Kirk's compliments to me were nearly always about my looks or purchases, not my ideas or good works or dreams, though I wasn't even sure what those were anymore. Had it always been that way with Kirk and me? Or was I just noticing it now that Finch was older and consuming so much less of my time? I felt a deep, aching loneliness, coupled with a painful longing for a simpler time. I missed all the chores that once felt so tedious, driving my son to school and to all his other activities, cooking breakfast and dinner for him, nagging him to go to bed, and even my least favorite, helping him with his homework at the kitchen table. All of that segued into thoughts of Tom and Lila, their single father-daughter relationship, Tom's reaction to Kirk, then me, Lila's feelings about everything that had happened to her. I wanted to talk to her so intensely that it didn't quite make sense. Only it did. As if there was no way not to make a connection between the present and the past. Her story and mine, ancient and buried though the memories were. It happened in the fall of my first semester at Vanderbilt, while I was still finding my footing and adjusting to a much bigger, fancier pond. I had been more than ready to graduate from high school and escape the mundane day-to-day of Bristol, but I was still a little homesick. More than missing my parents or home, my heart ached for Teddy, my boyfriend of nearly 2 years, who was 3 hours away in Birmingham, going to Samford University on a basketball scholarship. Teddy and I talked on the phone every night and wrote long letters by hand, always pledging our love and undying commitment to each other. There was no doubt in my mind that he was the one. In the meantime, though, I forged a fledgling friend group consisting of my roommate, Eliza, and another two girls on our hall, Blake and Ashley. Although the four of us were different in many ways, including geography, Eliza was from New York, Blake from L.A., and Ashley from Atlanta. The three of them all shared a certain wealthy worldliness, something I distinctly lacked. They'd all graduated from fancy private academies, while I'd gone to a run-of-the-mill public high school. They'd traveled the world and visited many of the same spots, like Aspen and Nantucket and Paris. They'd even been to more exotic places, like Africa and Asia, while my family's idea of a special trip was the Grand Canyon or Disney World. They were all foodies before that really became a thing, and they constantly bitched about the cafeteria food, which I actually thought was pretty good. They lived for the emerging restaurant scene in Nashville and didn't think twice about dropping their dad's credit cards to pay for entrees in the double digits, which I could never afford. I avoided those outings or declared myself not very hungry before finding something from the appetizer portion of the menu. Their wardrobes were insanely good, though Eliza and Blake went for edgier pieces than Ashley's Laura Ashley look. While my clothes were extremely basic, The Gap was my version of style. Although they weren't trying to be snobs, they just sort of naturally were that way, and I found myself struggling to keep up with their sophisticated frame of reference, vacillating between feeling clueless and feeling embarrassed. Frankly, Teddy didn't help matters. One weekend, He borrowed his buddy's truck and drove to Nashville, showing up out of the blue to surprise me with a bouquet of wildflowers he'd picked himself on the way. I was thrilled to see him, of course, and touched by the romantic gesture. But as the girls came around to meet him, I found myself feeling inexplicably embarrassed. In Bristol, Teddy was a big deal. Not only extremely handsome, but also a star athlete. As I looked at him through their eyes, he seemed a little too sweet, too simple, and very country. Even his thick drawl, which I'd always thought was so cute. He was actually born in Mississippi, and had grown up there until age 12. Now seemed to border on redneck, along with his many backwoods expressions. Things weren't broken, they were tore slap up. They weren't catty-cornered, they were catty-wonked. And he was never about to do something, he was fixin' to. His hair and clothes and shoes all seemed a bit off, too. Nothing I could put my finger on exactly, but somehow noticeably different from the boys at Vanderbilt. At least the ones my friends gravitated toward. Of course, it wasn't enough to shake my confidence in our love. I wasn't that shallow. But it did make me think a little about what my life would be like with him versus with someone else. Aside from anything having to do with Teddy himself, I also had the feeling my friends thought it was sort of lame of me to have come to school with such a serious boyfriend. One night, for example, the three of them were flipping through my yearbook. I never should have brought that sucker to college. They had all left theirs at home. And saw that Teddy and I had been named most likely to get married. It amused them to no end, which I couldn't quite understand.
"Oh my God, hysterical," Blake said, cracking up and exchanging a telling look with Ashley.
It wasn't the first time I had the feeling that they'd discussed me behind my back. I grabbed my yearbook from them and snapped it shut. "It doesn't mean we will get married," I said, feeling slightly guilty toward Teddy. "Just that we've been together the longest, or whatever."
"Hmm," Blake said.
Eliza asked, "Did I hear you guys fighting last night?" "We weren't really fighting," I said, trying to remember the precise topics from our marathon phone conversation. "We always started and ended well, but occasionally there was some petty insecurity and jealousy sprinkled in."
"Long distance never works," announced Blake, the self-proclaimed authority on dating of any kind.
"Don't say that," said Eliza, often somewhat protective of me, perhaps because I'd confided more in her. "It might."
"Are you at least going to see other people?" Ashley pressed.
"Or just cheat on him," Blake said, laughing.
"No and no," I said, aware of how naive I sounded to them, but not caring.
"But don't you want to experience sex with someone other than Teddy?" Blake asked as she lit a cigarette. "He might suck, for all you know. You need a basis for a comparison."
I swallowed and forced myself to make the confession I'd been avoiding.
"I actually haven't slept with Teddy yet," I said.
Eliza looked surprised, and the other two laughed and said some variation of,
"You gotta be kidding."
"No," I said, "but we've done everything else." This addendum didn't impress them.
"What? Why?" Ashley asked, as if I were the subject of a fascinating sociological study.
"I don't know. I just wanted to wait," I said, thinking of Julie and the vow we'd made during our freshman year in high school to wait as long as we could, and at least until college. I suddenly felt an intense pang of longing for the person I never had to explain these sorts of things to.
"Wait for what? Marriage?" Blake said. "Is it a religious thing?"
"No," I quickly said, feeling increasingly uncomfortable. Although Teddy believed sex outside marriage was wrong, he was willing to sin if I was.
"Oh, I thought Samford was a big Bible school," Blake said, her tone slightly critical, though I wasn't sure whether she was judging the Bible
or Samford as an academic institution.
Yeah, it's a Christian school, I said, but he's not a saint or anything.
Well, I think it's great to wait, Ashley said. Of all the girls, our values felt the closest, perhaps because we were both from the South.
Eliza and Blake nodded, but I could tell they weren't buying it, and that they put sex in the same category as sushi. By 18, you should have tried both, and California rolls and handjobs didn't cut it. For the first time, it occurred to me that they might be right, and that I was playing it too safe. After all, I was in college now. I needed to be a little bolder, broaden my horizons, start thinking for myself instead of relying so much on Teddy.
Okay, girls, I said, eager to change the subject. I'm ready for a drink.
In my head, I was ready for more than one. I was ready to get good and drunk for the first time. It was something else Teddy thought was wrong, and the few times I'd had a beer at a party, he disapproved. I once tried to talk him out of his stance, pointing out that people were constantly downing wine in the Bible.
But it also says to obey the law and be filled with the Spirit, he said, then explained to me that he'd gotten drunk once with friends and didn't like the way it had made him feel.
I was filled with spirits and not the Spirit.
I wasn't sure what he meant exactly and why you couldn't be filled with both, but I admired him for it. I still did admire him, but I decided that Teddy was more than 3 hours away and my college experience didn't have to mirror his. So I stood up, went back to our room, and made myself a cocktail from Eliza's makeshift minibar. She was out of mixers, so I poured Smirnoff into a plastic cup, then added a scoop of Crystal Light. Not even bothering with ice from the machine at the end of the hall, I began to chug. Almost instantly, I caught a strong buzz, feeling a rush of happiness and great affection for my friends and all things Vanderbilt. I then borrowed a short, tight halter dress from Eliza, and all the girls agreed that I looked hot. Their compliments about my figure, hair, and face were sincere, wistful, and frequent. I was also aware of all the male attention that greeted us everywhere we went, and I decided that being drunk at a party was way more fun than whining to Teddy on the phone from under the covers of the top bunk. Maybe my friends were right about long-distance relationships, I remember thinking, as I flirted and danced and continuously drank, haphazardly mixing beer and liquor. At the very least, maybe Teddy and I needed to start seeing other people. At some point, I got into a long, flirty conversation with one of Ashley's friends from home. His name was Zach Rutherford, and he had a mop of blonde hair and the cutest dimples. He was several inches shorter than I was, and on the scrawny side. Not my type, even if I didn't have a boyfriend. So I didn't feel guilty talking to him, then dancing with him. When he started to get really friendly, though, I told him that I was going to head back to my dorm.
I'll walk you home, he offered. I have a boyfriend, I blurted out.
Duly noted, Zach said, laughing. I'm not trying to hit on you, Nina. I'm just offering to walk you back.
I hesitated, then did a sidebar with Ashley, who reassured me that Zach was a good guy, adding that he was a nationally ranked golfer and could have gone to any school in the country.
Everyone in Atlanta wanted to date him, she said, her implication clear, even before she winked and added, you never know.
I shook my head and said, he's just walking me back. By then, though, I'd felt my first stab of guilty attraction and intrigue over Zach. But I really did need to get back, as by then I was wasted, and I told myself I really could use a male chaperone across campus. So off we went. Only before we got to my dorm, Zach asked if we could do a quick detour to his. He needed to get something, he said. I agreed, because I was drunkenly enjoying the walk and his company. Though at that point, I would have enjoyed just about anything. When we got to his dorm, I started to wait in the lobby lounge area, but he suggested I come to his room. I went along with it. A few minutes later, we were cozied up on his futon, sharing a beer and listening to R.E.M. croon Night Swimming. When he tried to kiss me, I went along with that, too, pushing Teddy as far from my mind as I possibly could. That's pretty much the last thing I vividly remember from the night, until I woke up in a strange bed, naked, next to a naked boy. At first, I couldn't even place that it was Zach, but then it all came back to me in a rush of horror. "Where are we?" I said, staring up at the bottom rails of a bunk bed.
"In my room," he mumbled.
"What happened? Did we?" I asked,
knowing we had because it hurt. A lot. In the faint fluorescent light from his closet, I could make out the blood, both on his sheets and streaked down the insides of my thighs.
"Yeah," he mumbled,
still either out of it or half asleep.
"Oh my God," I said. "No, no."
"You wanted to," he said, just as a flash of it came back to me, the moment he entered me. The pain, my balled fists and tears, my telling him, shouting at him, "No, stop, no." It was like a bad dream, but it was real. It had happened. The room spinning, I managed to sit up, frantically searching for my clothes, finding Eliza's white dress twisted up in his sheets, along with my underwear.
"You wanted to," he said again, his eyes only half open, his voice still slurring.
As I looked around in the dark for my shoes, I couldn't find them, so I headed out the door, barefoot, as Zach remained motionless in his bed. I ran back to my dorm, but I didn't cry until I got to my room and discovered with relief that Eliza was still out. I checked her dress for blood, relieved that there was none. I hung it up, then stripped out of my clothes, wrapped up in a towel, put on my flip-flops, and walked to the communal bathroom. I took the hottest and longest shower of my life, sobbing the whole time, then returned to my room, where I finally forced myself to play back the four messages on the answering machine. They were all from Teddy, as I knew they would be, his voice getting increasingly worried and agitated, asking me to call him no matter how late I got back, ending every message with, "I love you." I wanted to hear his voice more than anything in the world, but it was 4 in the morning, and I told myself he would be asleep and had an early class. I shouldn't wake him up. But deep down, I knew the real reason was that I couldn't bring myself to tell him what had happened any more than I could bring myself to lie to him. Instead, I called Julie, waking her up in her Wake Forest dorm room, telling her everything. Almost immediately, Julie used the word rape.
"It wasn't rape," I whispered, huddled under my covers. "I was kissing him."
"It was rape," Julie insisted, ahead of her time, or at least ahead of my 1995 views of what constituted date rape. "You need to go to the campus police, or better yet, the Nashville police."
I told her that was crazy. Besides, I'd already washed away all the evidence. Nobody would believe me.
"Yes, they will," she said. "You were a virgin."
I started to cry again. "I can't go to the police," I sobbed.
"Why not?"
"Because," I told her. "At the very least, I shared the blame. It was my mistake, too. My fault for leading him on. My cross to bear." I also told her that the only fair punishment was for me to lose Teddy. I would break up with him in the morning, or after his classes and practice. I had to break up with him. It was kinder than telling him what had actually happened.
"But you'll be punishing him, too," she said. "Don't do that, Nina. You have to tell him. You have to talk to him. He'll agree with me that you need to go to the police."
"No, I can't do that to him, Julie. It would ruin him. My drinking, the kissing, everything. He deserves better than me."
"But he loves you. He wants you."
"Not if he knew this," I said.
God teaches forgiveness, she said, grasping at straws, knowing the way Teddy thought, and that I knew that was the way Teddy thought.
No, I cried. Promise me, Julie. You won't tell him either. You won't tell anyone. Ever.
She made the promise, and she kept it, too, for all these years. Even between the two of us, we rarely spoke of it directly, although she made veiled references whenever a similar case arose in the media. Once, she even mentioned that what happened to me was part of why she was an advocate for women, her clientele almost exclusively female. She said she wished she had done more when she was younger. I guess the bottom line was, I wish I had done more too. Because I know that Zach Rutherford raped me. And although I truly believed that Finch hadn't done anything nearly that horrible to Lila, it was still terrible. Just like Zach, my son had taken advantage of an innocent girl who was in a vulnerable situation. He had exploited her, used her, treated her like trash. In many ways, Finch was Zach and I was Lila. And I didn't want Finch to haunt her the way Zach had haunted me. So I stood up, slinging my purse full of cash over my shoulder, and walked back to my car in the setting spring sun. I wasn't sure what I would do next, but it would be more than nothing. That was for sure.
Chapter 11. Tom. I've always considered myself lucky that I could mostly earn a living by doing what I love. But a bonus has been the sheer escape that comes with woodworking. What do they call it? Being in the zone or the flow? Whatever the case, I did my best to push everything out of my head that afternoon in my workshop. As I measured, marked, and cut shelves for a spruce bookcase, I felt myself start to relax for the first time in days, my mind going blissfully blank. Unfortunately, the shelves were too basic. I could have made them blindfolded. So before long, I found my thoughts returning to Nina Browning. I had almost been looking forward to hating her as much as I hated her husband and kid. And I couldn't wait to throw that goddamn pile of money in her face. Yet for some odd reason, I couldn't quite muster anything stronger than a mild, theoretical dislike for her, which was frustrating and disorienting. The fact that I felt like I'd met her before didn't help matters. Unlike Nina, I felt I was pretty good with faces. But the full truth was, I was good with certain faces, the same way I could remember an exceptional piece of furniture. Nina had that sort of vivid, memorable look. Very pretty, but not at all generic. I glanced at the old school clock mounted on the wall over my workbench and saw that it was nearly 7. Lila had gotten a ride home from school with Grace, but I tried to make it a point to be home for dinner, even when I planned to return to my workshop or squeeze in a few late-night Uber trips. I texted her now and asked what she wanted to eat, knowing she'd say she didn't care. Even when she wasn't angry with me, she had trouble making decisions. A minute later, the predictable reply came in. Don't care. Not hungry. As I swept up and put away my tools, my mind returned to Nina. Her face, her legs, which I'd caught a glimpse of when she stood up to say hello. There was no denying she was attractive, which pissed me off almost as much as the fact that I didn't hate her. I blew sawdust off my drill bit and told myself it didn't matter. She was an asshole. I knew her type. Only an asshole married a guy like that, and only an asshole would raise a son who would do what hers did, especially when he had everything in the world going for him. Privilege, popularity, Princeton. She'd said it herself. She was his mother. Women are just better at faking it, if and when they need to. and clearly Nina Browning was either a good actress or just plain crafty, a regular con artist. She knew to ask about Lila, feigning a little maternal compassion. Her ploy had very nearly worked on me until she overplayed her hand. There was no chance she wanted me to pursue the Honor Council charges against her son, especially given that he'd just been accepted to Princeton. Zilch. Why would she risk that for a girl she'd never met? She wouldn't, plain and simple. And to think I'd almost bought her reverse psychology bullshit. I pictured her now, drinking a martini with her friends, feeling smug about how she'd manipulated another guy with her bullshit lines. And that's when it hit me, where I had seen her before. It was about 4 years ago, maybe more, as I tended to underestimate the passage of time these days. She'd come to the home of a client who had hired me to redo cabinetry in what she called her keeping room. This woman, whose name I couldn't recall for the life of me, was about the same age and profile as Nina, meaning she too lived in a Bellmead mansion, though not as grand as Nina's. I'd actually gotten the initial call from her contractor explaining that she was impossible to please, hadn't been happy with the work of a former carpenter, and wanted me to start over from scratch. She didn't like his design, though she had signed off on the drawings. Nor did she like the materials he'd used, though she'd also approved his choice of teak. "I wouldn't blame you for not touching this one," the guy had said. "She's a real pain in the ass." I very nearly heeded his warning, but I needed the money, as always, so I took the gig. When I went over to meet her, I actually tried to talk her out of the redo, explaining the flaws she perceived in the teak would likely disappear with a coat of paint, and certainly two or three, and that, in my opinion, she'd be wasting her money. She was unconvinced and undeterred. Or maybe she just wanted to waste money. So I took the job, agreeing to use mahogany and a new, more detailed design with a lot of flourishes and scrollwork that she'd pulled from a design magazine and that I actually thought were a little too McMansion-y. Suffice it to say, the contractor was right. It was a long 3 weeks with this woman, though not because she was hard to please. She was thrilled with my work, but she never left me alone, never shut up or shut down her monologue of complaints about her life, whether online ordering snafus, her house was like a FedEx depot, or tennis team drama. Every day at 5 o'clock sharp, she'd open a bottle of wine, which was my cue to try to leave, and her cue to offer me overtime and a glass of my own. I explained more than once that I didn't drink on the job, at which point she'd assault me with peer pressure I hadn't experienced since junior high. "Oh, come on, don't be such a goody-two-shoes," she'd say. "One little glass." A couple times I relented, taking a few sips just to shut her up while she polished off the rest of the bottle, often then delving into complaints about her husband. How he was never around, that he didn't listen to her, that he bitched about her spending habits. And that's where Nina Browning came in, quite literally, showing up one evening for what looked to be a big night out. What's-her-name wasn't quite ready, so she handed her friend a glass of wine and told her she'd be back in a second. At least a half hour passed in which I continued to work, and Nina typed away on her phone in the adjoining kitchen. Meanwhile, we each pretended the other wasn't just a few feet away. At one point, she got a call, and I had the feeling it was from her husband or someone she was very close to, because she started speaking in a hushed voice, complaining about how What's-Her-Name was always late. When she hung up, she caught me looking at her, let out a little laugh and said, "You didn't hear that." I smiled and said something like, "Oh, yeah, I did. She's a great friend, but never on time." Maybe if she talked a little less? This made her laugh a real laugh, showing a lot of big white teeth and how pretty she was, and, perhaps more noteworthy, how unlike her friend she seemed to be. More real, less insecure. She was interacting with me as an equal, and not as the carpenter she could pay overtime to drink with her. A few minutes later, What's-Her-Name sauntered into the kitchen and announced that I could keep working. She trusted me in the house. She meant it as the highest of compliments, but of course, it was actually an insulting sentiment, which Nina picked up on with a subtle eye roll. Then they were gone. That was it, really. Not much of a meeting at all. But it was still a reference point that made me think it was possible that our conversation today had been sincere, rather than a coffee shop performance. Then again, they both could have been performances. I shut off the lights, locked up my workshop, and walked to my truck, telling myself none of this mattered. Whether she was a decent person was in some ways as wholly irrelevant as her looks. It didn't change what her son had done, and it wasn't going to change my decision. Yet, as I drove home, I found myself wondering about her, who she really was as a person. For some inexplicable reason, I wanted, somehow needed, to know the truth about Nina Browning, which is why I was more than a little intrigued when I received her email that night, and unable to resist the back and forth that followed. "Tom, thank you so much for meeting with me today. Although it was difficult, I'm glad we had the chance to talk through things. I was wondering if you'd be open to getting together again, this time with Finch and Lila. Obviously, I won't press the issue if you're uncomfortable with the idea. But I think it might be good for both of them. Let me know your thoughts. Best, Nina." Thank you for following up and for the offer. Let me talk to Lila and see how she feels. Oh, and I think I figured out where we met. Do you have a friend who lives in a brick house on Linwood? Pretty sure I met you while working there a number of years ago. T.
Oh, my goodness, yes, I do. Melanie Lawson, I totally remember chatting with you now, and this proves I am bad with faces, because I remember everything else about our conversation.
Smiley face. Nina.
P.S. You did a beautiful job at her house. She still raves about you.
P.P.S.
She's a Windsor parent, too. Did you know that?
No, I'm not really into the whole Windsor social scene.
I hear you. I love the school, but it is quite a scene at times. We've been there since Finch was in kindergarten, so I'm used to it at this point. Also, I'm not sure that this is at all relevant, but I feel like I should tell you that that's where the kids were the night in question, at Melanie's house. Her son had a party without her permission. Small world or something.
I'll go with, or something. And nothing is really in question, is it?
Yes. Two poor expressions to use under these circumstances. I'm sorry. And I'm so sorry again for what Finch did. I know those are just words, but they are heartfelt. I really want to try to make things right. I hope you believe that. And I hope Finch will have the chance to meet with Lila and tell her all of this himself.
Thanks. I'll talk to Lila and be in touch soon.
Chapter 12. Nina. There was no such thing as a kept secret in the Windsor community, and although I hoped the fire would be contained, I knew that it was only a matter of time before it raged. Based on my experience with other people's drama, I gave it a week. I was pretty much dead on, because by the following morning, 6 days after Beau's party, my phone was blowing up with friends, and even some acquaintances,
gingerly checking in on me. I suppose some were genuinely concerned over the development. But I think most were more in Kathy's camp, on some level, perhaps even subconsciously, reveling in the gossip and indifferent to the fact that they were so casually and cavalierly deepening the crisis, not only for Finch, who arguably deserved what he was getting, but also for Lala. I crafted a pat reply, "Thank you for your concern and kind words," and vowed to avoid my usual stomping grounds, all the places where I inevitably ran into the people I knew, Starbucks and Fix Juice, the Green Hills Mall and Whole Foods, my spin and yoga studios, and of course the club. The only person I continued to discuss it with was Melanie, who was so fiercely partisan that I think I could shoot someone on Bellevue Boulevard and she'd say I must have had a good reason. She sent me screenshot after screenshot from people opining on the matter, often with rumors they'd heard through the grapevine. Lila was completely naked. Finch had put something in her drink. The two had engaged in sexual activity. The story was constantly being embellished. Every time, Melanie came fiercely to Finch's defense, setting the record straight, typing replies in all caps with a bounty of exclamation points. Even when it came to the true parts of the story, she rationalized and insisted that this was a good kid who had made a mistake. On one level, I truly appreciated her loyalty, particularly when she was correcting falsehoods. On another, deeper level, her indignation made me incrementally more ashamed. After all, Finch was guilty. Maybe not guilty of all the accusations swirling around the rumor mill, but guilty nonetheless. It was a fact that seemed to be lost on her, just as it was on Kirk. On Friday evening, she showed up at my house, distraught and in disarray, at least by Melanie's high grooming standards. "What happened?" I said, opening the door. "Didn't you get my text? I told you I was on my way over." "No, I haven't looked at my phone for a bit," I said, having put it away so I would stop checking to see if Tom had written me back. It had not been 24 hours since I'd asked to meet with Lala, but I was starting to obsess over his decision. I led Melanie into the kitchen now. "Sit down," I said. "Tell me what's going on." She sighed and tossed her monogrammed Goyard tote at her feet before taking a perch on the kitchen stool. "That bitch, Kathy," she stopped, looked around and said, "Is anyone home?" "Kirk's not. He was home for 24 hours, but left again. Finch is here, but up in his room," I said. "So fire away." She pressed one hand to her temple as the other played with the folds of her tennis skirt. "That bitch, Kathy, is now telling people that Beau hooked up with Lila after Finch took the picture." "Did he?" I asked at my own peril. Melanie and I had never had an argument, but she could be oversensitive and thin-skinned, especially when it related to Beau or her daughter Violet, who had more diva tendencies than any child I'd ever known who wasn't on a sitcom. "Oh, God, no," she said, her spray-tanned leg bouncing on the bar stool. "What's she basing that on, then?" I said. "Just Lila being on Beau's bed in the photograph?" "I have literally no clue, but I bet Lucinda is behind it. She's a total see you next Tuesday. I detest that child. She's been posting articles on Facebook about sexual assault and misogyny." Melanie reached down and pulled her phone out of her bag, then began to read in a high, prissy voice, presumably imitating Lucinda. 44% of reported sexual assaults take place before a victim is 18. 1 in 3 girls is sexually abused prior to leaving high school. And yet secondary schools are irresponsibly reluctant to act on this information, resulting in the current frequency of college sexual assaults. I felt a stab of grief, thinking about both Lila and my own experience at Vanderbilt. I know Lucinda is as obnoxious as her mother, but unfortunately, she's right. If it were coming from someone else, it would still be obnoxious, Melanie said. Keep your opinions off social media. I actually disagreed with her, and thought that activism of this kind is one of the only decent upshots of social media. Otherwise, it's just a regular brag or snooze fest, a way to either show off your vacation or bore everyone with your Brussels sprouts. I almost said something along those lines, but Melanie was on a roll. I mean, Finch and Beau are good kids from good families, she said once again, removing an elastic band from her hair, shaking it out, then putting it up in a fresher ponytail. And Lala is so not their type. She is very pretty, though, I said, mostly just musing aloud. Have you seen her in person? I shook my head and said, no, but I saw other photos of her. Is she mulatto? Beau said she is. Is that true? Mulatto? I haven't heard that in years, I said, wondering if it was still politically correct and feeling pretty certain that it was not. She shrugged. Whatever the term is, mixed, biracial, I can't keep it straight. Is she? She's half Brazilian, I said. Huh, she said. So her mom must be foreign, because I heard her dad's white. I also heard her mother's in jail for drugs and prostitution. No wonder Lala's so promiscuous. Who said she was promiscuous? I asked, thinking that Melanie was trying to have it both ways. Lala didn't do anything that night with our boys, yet she was also promiscuous? Which one was it? Did you not see her outfit? Melanie tugged on her tank as she made a cross-eyed, tongue-lolling face. Come on, Mel. You know better than that, I said, tensing. An outfit doesn't make someone promiscuous. That's almost like saying she wore a short skirt so she had it coming. Melanie stared at me for a beat, then said, okay, what's going on? Why are you so team Lala? I don't get it. I'm not, I said. I just have the feeling she's a nice girl who got caught up in something she didn't ask for. And why do you think that? Because I had coffee with Lala's father, I blurted out, as my mind exploded with a flowchart of possible repercussions that came from Melanie knowing this. She was well-intentioned in our friendship, but had an absolute inability to keep much of anything to herself. You did? She said, probably already mapping out who she would tell the second she left my house. When? Yesterday, I said, making a split-second decision not to make it more irresistible by telling her to keep it a secret. It was no big deal, really. It just felt like the right thing to do. She nodded. So, what was he like? You've actually met him, I said. His name is Tom Volpe. Ring a bell? She gave me a blank stare, shook her head, then said, wait, that does sound familiar. How do I know that name? She repeated Volpe under her breath a couple times, frowning as if trying to place him. He did your butler's pantry, I said, and your keeping room shelves. Her face suddenly lit up. Oh, yeah, that Tom, right. He was hot, you know, in a scruffy blue-collar way. The characterization slightly annoyed me, though I couldn't pinpoint why, especially given that it was a pretty accurate description. In any case, I just nodded and said, yeah, I guess. Wait, his daughter is Lala? I nodded. That's surprising, she said. Why? I asked. I don't know. Because he's a carpenter, I guess. There aren't a lot of carpenter's kids at Windsor. She must be on financial aid. Maybe. Who knows? I said, resisting the temptation to add, and who cares? Instead, I said, but if she came in the ninth grade, then she also must be pretty smart, or super talented in some area. Everyone knew that admission standards became more stringent in high school, whereas the criteria for 5- and 6-year-olds were considerably broader and had much more to do with who your parents were. Nobody said it, but it seemed pretty clear that if two applicants were completely equal, but for the ability to make a big donation, the big donation won. To Kirk, there was nothing troubling about that. It was just life. Or maybe she got in because of the mulatto thing, Melanie said,
how Walter is about diversity? I shrugged, feeling intensely uncomfortable. To deflect, I pointed at a bottle of Pinot Noir that I'd opened with dinner and said, "Would you like a glass?" "Maybe just a teensy one. I'm trying to cut down on sugar. I'm so fat. Ugh." She leaned forward so that she could get a pinch of skin covering her washboard stomach as I poured a glass and handed it to her. She took a sip, then said, "So, details. Did he ask to meet with you or what?" "No, I asked to meet with him," I said, refilling my glass too. "Why? To talk him out of pressing charges?" "No," I said, "to apologize to him." "Oh, yeah, of course. I just thought there might be something else," she said, bouncing her foot again and looking wounded. It was an expression she wore often. In some ways, I loved this vulnerability about her, even when it felt misplaced. It was unlike so many of the other housewives of Bellmead, who wore perma-masks of bliss. From those types, the answer to the simple and actually not very curious question, "How are you doing?" was always a gushing litany of how wonderfully full and satisfying their lives were. "Busy, busy, busy. Happy, happy, happy. All good. Busy, happy, and good." I had one friend who would actually answer with a chipper, "Better than terrific." Her marriage, her kids, her holidays, her summer were all, always better than terrific. Even the breezy, "I can't complain," grated on me. First of all, sure, you can complain, and you do, and you will. You'll complain about your kids' teachers and coaches, your neighbors and your neighbors' pets, your fellow committee members on whatever charity or school function you're working on, whether it's because they're not doing their fair share or because they're being too bossy and trying to take the whole thing over. You'll complain when people don't reply fast enough to your correspondence, or when they hit reply all, giving you needless information that swamps your oh-so-important inboxes. You'll complain over your housekeepers and nannies and gardeners and anyone at all who comes into your home to do any kind of work for you. You'll complain over everything and nothing unless it is any kind of reflection on you, your kids, your marriage, or your life. And if, God forbid, you or your children make a misstep, you blame everyone else and insist that you are the victim from a good family. I knew the drill. "Can I just say," Melanie began now, "it hurts my feelings a little bit that you didn't tell me, especially since Beau's involved." "But I just told you." "I mean, sooner, right away, before you even met with him." "I guess I forgot to mention it," I fibbed. "I'm sorry, Mel." Her frown lines grew as deep as her Botox would allow. "Did he mention Beau? Or the party itself? Is he mad about that?" "No," I said. "I'm pretty sure that's the least of his concerns right now." Melanie nodded, then took a deep breath. "Listen, I admire you, Nina, so much. You're such a good person, and your heart's in the right place. I admire the fact that you're trying to make this right, but I really think you're being too hard on yourself and Finch." I nodded, torn. Her steadfast loyalty certainly felt better than Julie's tough love. Yet I was also frustrated by her inability, or at least refusal, to see what was at stake. I guess my friends couldn't win. I knew that's what Kirk would say if he could read my mind now. He hated when I got this way, at least when my feelings threatened his agenda. "You're impossible to please," he'd tell me. "Move on and stop obsessing." Of course, he obsessed over plenty of things, too. But in his mind, those things were different. They were obsession-worthy because they were about the big financial picture or another quantifiable issue. It was almost as if anything related to relationships or emotions was trivial to him. A disagreement with my mother? She'll get over it. A friend getting on my nerves? Stop hanging out with her. A feeling that I wasn't doing enough in the world or guilt about all we had. We give more than enough money away to charity. And now,
our own son's character? He's a good kid who made one little mistake. Move on, let it go.
Are you even listening to me? I heard Melanie say.
Sorry, I spaced out there for a second, I said.
I was just asking about Polly and Finch.
What about them?
How's Finch doing with the breakup? She said, lowering her voice.
They broke up? I hadn't heard, I said, feeling a stab of maternal guilt for being the last to know.
Yeah, honestly, though, I think Finch could do so much better than Polly. I've said that from the beginning.
Everyone thinks so, Melanie said.
Marveling that Polly's inferiority to Finch could still be Melanie's conclusion given recent events, I said,
I don't know, Mel. I bet she broke up with him. I'd break up with a boy for doing what he did to another girl.
It was so mean. Please stop torturing yourself, honey. Kids make mistakes, especially boys. Remember that psychiatrist who told us that the frontal lobe of a boy's brain isn't developed until, like, age 25? They use bad judgment without a fully developed frontal lobe.
I shrugged, then reiterated the point I'd made to Kirk. To me, this wasn't about judgment so much as morals.
Come on, Nina. You need to be an advocate for your own child.
What about Lala? Shouldn't we be advocates for all children?
Let Tom worry about Lala. Let him be her advocate. You need to be Finch's. You should always side with your kid. Always.
Without regard to his actions, I asked.
No matter what?
No matter what, she said, crossing her arms.
What if Beau killed someone, I said, testing the theory.
Well then, we'd hire the very best defense lawyers. O.J. Simpson type lawyers. And if we lost, I would visit him in jail every single day until I died. She took a deep breath.
Beau will always be my flesh and blood. I couldn't stop loving him. Ever.
Of course, I get that, I said, feeling a wave of defensiveness. I mean, I too would love Finch no matter what. I could even see where she was coming from with respect to hiring the best attorney and being hopeful that he might get a lighter sentence. After all, that is our legal system, which I do believe in. But I also knew in my heart that I wouldn't cover for my son if he committed a terrible crime. Any crime. I wouldn't lie for him. I wouldn't obstruct justice for him. I would stand by him, but I would also want him to confess and truly repent and bear responsibility for his actions. I would want him to earn and deserve his forgiveness. I tried to summarize the distinction to Melanie, but she wasn't having it, digging deeper with her next statement.
Well, I would do anything it took to protect Beau from pain. Anything.
Our eyes locked as the truth slowly sank in. The fact that I just didn't feel the same. I thought of a sermon I'd once heard at Teddy's church a long time ago. Pastor Sundermeyer had said something along the lines of, justice isn't only about what a person deserves, but also about what a person needs. It was a crucial piece of the puzzle that Melanie and Kirk seemed to be missing.
Well, for what it's worth, Kirk agrees with you, I said.
She nodded, looking vindicated.
Of course he does. He has excellent instincts when it comes to these things.
I thought about the $15,000, knowing that although Melanie probably would have approved of his ploy, she likely would also have scoffed at the amount, as she never minded overpaying. One of her mantras being, just throw money at the problem.
Not always, I said. Sometimes he's a little too results-driven. He always gets what he wants.
Yeah, she said with a little laugh. That's sort of why you married him, isn't it? She was referring to our story, the one Kirk loved to tell. How he had pursued me throughout our sophomore year at Vanderbilt, asking me out a half dozen times before I finally said yes. Of course, he believed I was merely playing hard to get, which had raised my stock in his eyes. And I never told him the truth. That I'd been too scarred by the traumatic events of my freshman year to even consider dating anyone for a long time. Looking back, though, maybe Melanie had a point. I did admire my husband's tenacity, and it probably did have something to do with why we ended up together. If I'm being honest, I have to admit I also liked how much my friends liked him, how well he fit in with everyone. He took my mind off bad things. He made me feel safe, like nothing bad would happen to me on his watch. I guess so, I murmured, as Melanie and I drank wine and I contemplated my own intentions. Why did I so badly want to meet with Lila and talk to Tom again? Was it really just about Finch learning from his mistakes and my doing the right thing? Or was I seeking some sort of absolution, maybe even vindication for my younger self? I wasn't sure, but I suddenly and desperately wanted to be alone. Oh my goodness, I said, forcing a fake yawn. I'm so tired. Yeah, me too, she said. I should go. I quickly stood, knowing how often I should go resulted in an additional hour of conversation. Hang in there, honey, she said, giving me a big hug. Get some rest and leave this to Kirk. Trust me, it will all be over soon. As soon as Melanie walked out the door, I couldn't get to my phone fast enough. Amid the usual mass mail, two emails jumped out at me. The first was from Walter Quarterman, the second from Tom Volpe. My heart raced as I opened Walter's first and read the short message informing Kirk and me that Finch's closed hearing before the Honor Council was scheduled for this coming Tuesday at 9 a.m. He apologized for the delay, but explained that two faculty members on the council had been away at a conference. He added that we were welcome to come to school that day, but would not be permitted in the room during the questioning. Okay, I said aloud to myself, relieved to see the date finalized. 4 more days. I took a deep breath, then opened the second email. From Thomas Volpe to Nina Browning. Subject: Hello. Hi, Nina. I think you're right. It is a good idea for the four of us to sit down together. Does this weekend work? Tomorrow around 11? You are welcome to come to our house. I prefer that to yours. Our address is in the directory. Feeling intensely anxious, but also grateful and hopeful, I composed a reply. From Nina Browning to Thomas Volpe. Subject: Thank you. Tom, I greatly appreciate your decision. Tomorrow morning absolutely works. We will see you at your place at 11 a.m. Thank you again so much. I hit send just as Kirk's name lit up on my phone. I answered as he barked into my ear. That asshole took the cash and is still letting this go to trial. So much for a gentleman's agreement. A gentleman's agreement? I said, so aghast by this ridiculous spin that I further rationalized not telling him that Tom had returned the money. I knew two wrongs didn't make a right, but he didn't deserve the truth. He deserved to feel screwed. A settlement, yes. It wasn't a gentleman's agreement or a settlement. It was a bribe. You tried to pay him off to keep quiet, and it backfired, I said. Try not to sound so happy about it, he said. I'm not happy about this, I said. I'm not happy about anything right now. Well, Kirk said, that makes two of us. A few minutes later, I went to Finch's room. His door was closed. I stared at it for a few seconds, thinking of how much things had changed, both quickly and gradually. When he was a little boy, his door stayed open, and he often ended up in our bed. By the time he reached late elementary school, he would occasionally close it, but I felt free to open it without knocking. When he was in middle school, I did a quick knock before walking in. Once he was in early high school, I awaited his permission following the knock. And in the last year or two, all bedroom chats had become non-existent. I barely entered his room at all, as Juana did his laundry and put away all his clean clothes. I knocked now, then opened the door to find Finch on his bed. He was on his laptop and wearing headphones. He looked up at me blankly. Hi, I said, Ah, he replied. Can you take those off? There's no sound, he said. Take them off anyway. He did, with no attitude.